process of deciding who their father would choose as his vice presidential pick. By July 11th, Donald and his team had whittled down the list to three names. Chris Christie was in there. So was Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House turned cable news pundit and Trump cheerleader. Indiana Governor Mike Pence, a Christian conservative straight out of central casting, made the shortlist too, as the clear favorite of many members of the Trump team, as well as Republican leaders like House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. The first two, however, had proved themselves not only loyal friends, but people Donald actually liked and wanted to shoot the shit with. Two of his most valued qualities. Pence, he barely knew beyond the political boxes he checked and the polling numbers his aides presented him with. They certainly made an odd couple, a thrice-married adulterer who boasted about grabbing women's genitals, and a man who would not even go to dinner with a woman who wasn't his wife, who he affectionately calls Mother. That Monday started what looked a lot like Sweeps Week in the VP sweepstakes. On Sunday, Donald met with Pence in Indiana. On Monday, Donald told people that the vetting file his team prepared on Gingrich made Donald look like a saint by contrast, effectively knocking him out of the running. And so by the time Tuesday rolled around, it looked as though there were only two options on the table. Though in Trumplandia, nothing is ever really a done deal until it's a done deal. And even then, he could still walk things back or reverse course without acknowledging that a shift had even happened. On Tuesday, Pence introduced the candidate at a private fundraiser and public rally in Westfield, Indiana. "We are ready to put a fighter, a builder, and a patriot in the Oval Office," he shouted to the crowd. Trump, ever the reality television host drumming up interest, asked his supporters how Pence was doing in his job as governor. "Good? I think so," he joked. "I don't know if he's going to be your governor or vice president. Who the hell knows?" By that point, certainly not Donald Trump. That evening, he got stranded in Indiana. Somewhat of a catastrophe for a man of creature comforts who almost always opted to fly back to New York, no matter how late a campaign stop ran or how nonsensical it was in the midst of a jam-packed travel schedule. But Trump Force One had some sort of mechanical problem, so there he would stay. He rolled through a phone interview with the Wall Street Journal, in which he told the paper he was looking for a fighter skilled in hand-to-hand combat as a running mate. Christie and Gingrich, he said, were two extraordinary warriors. Chemistry was important, too, which he said also gave the two men a boost. "You either have it or you don't. I clearly have it with Chris and Newt." As for Pence, he didn't know him enough to judge how much of an extraordinary warrior he could be or whether they had chemistry or not. At about 10 p.m., Donald called Christie, who was in a hotel in Washington. "Are you ready?" Donald asked his friend. "Ready for what?" Christie asked. "Are you ready?" Donald repeated. Christie didn't want to play coy. He asked if Donald was offering him the nomination. Donald hemmed and hedged. He said he had not made his final decision yet, but wanted to know if Christie was up for it, and if his wife, Mary Pat, would be willing to pick up some slack on the trail since Melania wasn't keen on campaigning. Donald ended the call by telling him to stay by his phone. Donald hung up and made a call to his family, telling them that he liked Christie. He felt comfortable with him and knew he'd tear the skin off Hillary Clinton in the general election, and he needed someone who'd willingly, skillfully do that. His kids quickly hung up with their father and called Keith Schiller, Donald's longtime bodyguard. They were all coming to Indiana to stage a vice presidential intervention. The next morning, Donald, Don Jr., Ivanka, Jared, and Eric, along with campaign chair Paul Manafort, turned up in Indiana for breakfast at Pence's home. Jared privately told Pence that he needed to turn on the charm for his father-in-law. Otherwise, the gig would slip through his hands before the dishes were even cleared from the table that morning. The meal went well enough that it buoyed Donald a bit, swaying him slightly from the assuredness he'd felt the night before. Still, that evening, he told Fox News' Bret Baier that multiple contenders, maybe as many as even four, were still in the mix, though he was debating between two. I tell you, Chris Christie is somebody I have liked for a long time, he told the host. He is a total professional. He's a good guy, by the way. A lot of people don't understand that. He added that their meeting had gone really well. He has always been very respectful to me and really appreciates what I've done politically, he said, and we had a great meeting. At the outset, he said he would announce his decision by Friday. Adding to the pressure, Friday happened to be the deadline for Pence to decide whether or not he would continue with his re-election bid. By Thursday evening, Donald was agitated and uncertain about Pence, chafing at being locked into making a choice under deadline. Jared reminded him that he was choosing a guy who'd make the ticket strongest and bridge the divide within the Republican Party, not a best buddy. Manafort agreed with Jared, adding that he was worried Christie wouldn't be as easy to handle, and reminding Donald of Christie's own presidential ambitions. He couldn't choose someone who wanted the role for himself. Never mind the fact that very often that is not the case, Donald heard them. But he was still uneasy. He didn't know what to do. But his family was pushing him in Pence's direction. That evening, a terrorist drove a 19-ton rental truck onto the sidewalk of the Promenade des Anglais in Nice, France, after the annual Bastille Day fireworks, killing 86 people and injuring dozens more. Out of respect for the victims, the campaign initially decided to delay the announcement, but Donald grew restless, and a little bit before 10 o'clock in the morning, he tweeted out his pick. I am pleased to announce that I have chosen Governor Mike Pence as my vice presidential running mate. News conference tomorrow at 11 a.m. When he talked to Christie, Donald told the governor that Pence just looked like a vice president. I have to take him, he said. He told him that if he won any other job he wanted, all he'd have to do was ask for it. Long before the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Jared reached out to two speechwriters, Matthew Scully and John McConnell. These guys were the real deal. They worked closely with President George W. Bush in crafting his speeches, including the addresses he gave after the September 11 attacks. Jared wanted them to come up with a bang-up speech for his stepmother-in-law to give on stage at the RNC. Melania was such a reticent campaigner that she hardly ever accompanied her husband on his many campaign stops. She had a young son at home in New York whose life she wanted to keep as normal as possible. She still tried to pick him up at school as often as possible, though that grew increasingly difficult as time wore on given the traffic her Secret Service detail caused at dismissal time. None of this politics stuff had been her idea. She liked her life, and why shouldn't she? Most of it was guarded within her gilded doors and planes and homes on golf courses either bearing her husband's name or at which he was the boss. She was a former model, so the attention wasn't the problem, but she was not a native English speaker, and she saw how the press ripped her husband to shreds every day. No one in their right mind would be happy about throwing themselves to those wolves. Jared wanted her rare appearance to be a hit. Not only would this boost the campaign, appealing to Americans who might have been turned off by the candidate's multiple marriages and treatment of women, but also, maybe if she knocked it out of the park, she would be more willing to jump into the political fray more often. She polled well, and with Trump going up in the coming months against the first female general election candidate, having a woman on the team who people liked, who softened and defended her husband, couldn't hurt. McConnell and Scully agreed. About a month before the convention, they shot her over a draft. A response never came. Instead, Melania turned to people within her inner circle to rip the draft to shreds. It did not sound like her. She wanted to essentially start fresh. One of the people who helped her was Meredith McIver, a former professional ballet dancer and Trump employee who had helped write Donald's book, Think Like a Billionaire. A handful of others had their hands in it as well. None of them stopped Melania from getting on stage on the Monday night of the convention to deliver an address to 23 million viewers that stole entire phrases and themes from a speech Michelle Obama had given years earlier at a Democratic National Convention. Immediately, the Trump campaign spun into damage control mode. It was nearly impossible to understand how this colossal and entirely avoidable mistake could have slipped by so many people. How could a gang who couldn't even protect the potential First Lady from not straight up ripping off a former First Lady's speech word for word be trusted to run a winning campaign, let alone protect the United States of America? Melania Trump was barely off stage before journalists figured out that much of her speech was borrowed. It took little more time before the finger-pointing within the Trump campaign began. On Tuesday morning, Ivanka and Jared blew off steam in their hotel gym, as did a number of other campaign officials. Jared walked up to one official who was pedaling idly on the stationary bike as he tried to catch up on the rest of the headlines, as if anyone was talking about anything other than Melania Gate, and for a brief moment, forget about the whole thing. "You know, this is all Manafort's fault," he told the official, who questioned why it was Manafort's responsibility or duty to proofread the candidate's wife's speech and make sure she hadn't plagiarized it from Michelle Obama. A month later, Manafort was fired. In the process of figuring out who the campaign should bring in to replace Manafort, members of the team knew they had to find someone who could right a ship that, by that point, was foundering. The whole tone of the Republican National Convention was dour, downtrodden, and fearful. By contrast, the Democratic Convention felt like a shining city on a hill in which most Americans would prefer to live, regardless of how realistic or euphemistic it was. Donald was entangled in public feuds with a former beauty pageant contestant who said he'd made unkind remarks about her weight, and the Khans, a Gold Star Muslim family who criticized the Trump campaign's rhetoric at the DNC. His poll numbers dipped. They needed a new jolt. Jared started asking his friends and campaign advisors close to his father-in-law for options. Ivanka knew that bringing a woman on might help with the optics, even if, as a fairly obvious political calculation, it would likely be met with snickering. Ultimately, Jared believed no one would run the campaign better than he would. He had been the de facto campaign manager for months anyway, but he agreed with his wife. He started asking around for names of women to whom he could give the title of campaign manager, though she would mostly just be going out on TV and talking like the campaign manager. He would still be calling the shots. The people he asked were gobsmacked. What woman in her right mind would come on board knowing that she was getting a fake job to make Donald look good while Jared was the one actually running the show? He wouldn't tell her that, he'd reply. Most people figure that he would drop the idea. It was under those conditions that, not long after, Kellyanne Conway joined the campaign, officially becoming the first female campaign manager in a general election bid in the history of the United States. On Monday, September 19th, the Secret Service officially started protecting Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner and their children. Her brothers hadn't yet received protection. Her father had received his detail nearly 10 months earlier, going with the Secret Service code name Mogul. Since the call signs within a first family all begin with the same first letter, the rest of the Trumps fell in line with M names as well. This naming tradition, which dates back to President Harry Truman, has since its inception sometimes been a way for commanders-in-chief to live out their fantasies, a game of high-stakes make-believe in which the most powerful men in the world get to try on a name to match the image of themselves they wish were true. Truman, for instance, decided to be called General, though he had only been a captain in World War I. The Kennedys' names all referred to Camelot. The Obamas stuck with Renegade and Renaissance. But the point of the practice is much more significant than fantasy fulfillment. The call signs are used in an emergency when protection enacts continuity of operation plans. If there is a crisis, it's safer to say, "We have Mogul," than "We have Donald Trump," particularly if the Secret Service is operating on unsecure communications lines. But the Secret Service does not come up with these names themselves. Family members are given a series of names from the White House Communications Agency from which each protectee can choose. Melania settled on Muse. Ivanka landed on Marvel. Her brothers received their details later, but Eric, A spectacular shot chose marksman, and Don Jr., for obvious reasons, picked mountaineer. From the start, Ivanka was keen on the idea of security protecting her and her young family. Part of it had to do with the aura it gave her as a political power player. In Washington, at least, the presence of a detail, the men with earpieces and the black SUVs, is a status symbol. It's the swamp equivalent of a bona fide entourage in Hollywood. The man assigned to head Ivanka's initial detail, it just so happens, was nicknamed Hollywood by his Secret Service colleagues and former protectees. He loved to make small talk about designers and celebrities and what clothes everyone was wearing. Instantly, he fell into step with the family. He had just spent years as an integral member of First Lady Michelle Obama's detail, so he was not only sensitive to protecting a family managing children, not necessarily of Washington, and also understood the intricacies of working with a female protectee. It was not exactly comfortable for either party to have a male Secret Service member accompany a woman protectee to a gynecologist appointment, for instance, or a Pilates class. Hollywood, though, had spent years learning how to make it more palatable and less intrusive. He understood the importance of keeping his protectees' public and personal lives separate and immediately deflected attention from them, enough so that they were able to take weekend trips or observe Shabbat without cameras snapping photos of them at every turn. Ivanka, for her part, had spent a lifetime surrounded by live-in help. Many members of First Families past have never had nannies or housekeepers or bodyguards around. But for Ivanka, having people around whose sole job was to serve and protect her was a way of life that had been ingrained in her since she was born. This part of the transition suited her just fine. It helped that the communication between Jared and Ivanka and their detail was open. From the get-go, they were honest with their detail about the possibility of their moving to Washington, which helped the Secret Service come up with a plan from the beginning. They instantly welcomed the detail into their lives, and members of their detail grew quite fond of the couple. When they visited the Kushner family home in New Jersey to observe the Jewish High Holidays, Jared would recommend places nearby for the detail to grab a good dinner or a drink at the bar. He surprised them by picking semi-cool dive bars that none of the Secret Service men could believe Jared himself had actually been to, though he insisted he had. And as the Trump Kushners gravitated more to the five-star hotel and private plane end of the spectrum, a place on their detail became one of the more desirable assignments in the administration. In administrations past, the plum gigs had usually been on the First Lady's detail, known as the FLD. Jokingly, agents have dubbed the FLD fine living and dining, because most First Ladies make so many trips to so many lovely places, go out to the best restaurants, and take a few vacations with their kids with their detail in tow. This First Lady stuck closer to home, or homes in the Trump's case. She rarely made public appearances or traveled anywhere other than Trump Tower, Bedminster, New Jersey, or Mar-a-Lago. She didn't socialize outside much either. Ivanka, on the other hand, more than made up for it. She crisscrossed the country, flitted about vacation spots at luxury resorts, frequented glitzy parties and hot restaurants, and stayed at several city and beach and country homes. In jest, some agents started referring to Ivanka's detail as FLD Light. Since the typical FLD didn't exist in Trumplandia, Ivanka's, more than anyone's, was the assignment to get. Ivanka's siblings had a tougher time. Don Jr., marksman, in particular chafed at the idea of protection for several reasons. For starters, he was generally more private than his sister. He went to his home in the Catskills to fish and build bonfires and roam around on ATVs with his kids most weekends, and took off for days-long hunting trips in the most remote parts of the Canadian bush looking for moose and 10-day boys fishing trips in Alaska. He wore flannel shirts and baseball caps, sometimes full camp suits with neon orange vests. He flew mostly commercial in coach, hopscotching from one flight to a small airport onto a tiny plane into a far-flung town no one on the Upper East Side had ever heard of. "I have friends that only know me as Don," he said of the people he meets out upstate or in hunting camps. "They find out what my last name is and they're like, 'I had no idea.' You see them the next time they're trying to treat you differently, and you're like, what happened? Why should that make any difference? They'll say, you're right. It's a great equalizer. Some of the guys he'd met just as Don more than a decade before at shooting ranges upstate were law enforcement officials. Don, at the time, was just starting off in the business world at his father's company, and these guys were just starting off in the police force or at the lowest level of the Secret Service. As Don's role and responsibilities within the Trump Organization grew, so too did his shooting buddies. Some of the guys he'd gone shooting with and hung around with upstate were now assigned to follow him around and look after his family. All of a sudden, he went from no last name city boy Don to protectee. He was entitled to their service and responsible for pseudo-managing them. For a guy who'd spent years being uncomfortable with them treating him differently because of his last name, this crossed into prickly territory almost overnight. That Don and his wife Vanessa had five kids living in New York City didn't help matters. That meant that Vanessa had to manage essentially six different details, one for her and her husband, and one for each of her children. Her phone lit up with texts and calls from agents telling her one kid was a few minutes late to meet them on their designated street corner, asking if they would be on the north or the south side of the street, what time she planned to leave the house for their drive upstate for the weekend, or who was staying late at school that afternoon. It is literally overwhelming, a former Secret Service agent explained. Trying to manage all of that with seasoned staff would be mind-numbing. To have someone who's never done it before try and juggle all of that, well, it would just be horrific. The head of the detail didn't make it easier. Unlike Hollywood, he didn't instantly mesh with the family. There were some preliminary conversations about a potential move to D.C., so they put him in place as a temporary stopgap who might be replaced if the eventual relocation did happen. But it didn't, and they ended up with what came to be a revolving door of agents and shifting dynamics. It was hard for them to get into a rhythm or find a comfortable relationship. The whole thing has just been sloppy, the former agent said. The agents have been sloppy. The communication has been sloppy. Don's back-and-forth attitude about them has been sloppy. Hiring someone to help Vanessa coordinate might have made it easier, but the family didn't spend the money. It was simpler for Eric and his wife, Laura. At the time, it was just the two of them. Laura got pregnant in the midst of the campaign, so for months, there was no extra detail to coordinate, and they had 40 weeks to plan for an eventual detail. Tiffany's detail was perhaps the laxest of all. One morning, at the end of May, she walked in the front door of the Golden Pear in East Hampton, a tiny, teeming CNBC spot smack in the middle of Newtown Lane, the town's little main street. The Golden Pear is some 200 feet from the Monogram Shop, a little personalization store that, each year since the 2004 presidential election, has sold plastic cups labeled with campaign logos for each major party candidate, sold for $3 a piece to Hamptonites to display on their marble islands or pass around at their catered beach barbecues. The shop owner starts keeping track after the Super Tuesday primary contests in March, and at the close of business each day, she handwrites the total number of cups sold for each candidate on a piece of paper that she hangs in the store window. Since this custom started, the cups had accurately predicted the winner, first with George W. Bush, then with Obama twice. But this cycle, the cups, like every pollster and expert and analyst, got it wrong. Up until the weekend before the election, the Monogram Shop had sold 4,946 for Hillary Clinton and just 3,388 for Donald Trump. Tiffany didn't stop in to buy one of her father's cups that morning, as Chelsea Clinton once did the year her mother ran against Barack Obama in the primaries. She chose to spend her $3, likely four times that given their prices, on four iced coffees with her boyfriend. She dropped one iced coffee, and no one flinched or helped her pick it up, not even her detail, who was standing at a nearby table, noticeably playing a game on his phone. Most people didn't notice her, besides the brief spill disturbance. She was in a baseball cap, and her security presence was so minimal that other customers readily came in and out both the front and back doors without so much as a glance. At one point, someone did approach her, at which point she perked up, expecting some sort of comment, though who knows which way that would have gone. Her detail didn't step in to block the approach, which would have been unnecessary anyway since the patron was simply asking if he could steal the extra chair at her table. One customer that morning had also been in the Golden Pear one day in the 1990s when Chelsea Clinton and her several Secret Service agents walked in. The world basically stopped, he recalled. For Tiffany, no one really noticed, and the people who did were intentionally looking in the opposite direction. Chapter 3. Election Day. Police shut down 57th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenues mid-morning on Election Day for the Trump motorcade. The cars slid up in front of Public School 59, a school-turned-polling station for the day, just blocks from Trump Tower. Red and blue lights flashed against silver barricades set up to hold back the dozens of people who'd gathered outside to get a glimpse of the candidate and both cheer and boo him before he cast his ballot. He and Melania stepped out of a black SUV, Ivanka, Jared, and their daughter Arabella following seconds behind. They all went down to the school's gymnasium, filled at that point with agents in boxy suits and earpieces, cameramen clicking away, and reporters shouting questions at the Trumps. The family, all in neutrals, popped against the gym's baby blue and banana yellow walls. Apart from Donald, who'd walked in wearing only a suit jacket, all of them kept their coats on inside. Melania's Balmain coat, with its wide lapel and gold buttons, hung on her shoulders, leaving her arms free. Ivanka kept her cream trench coat belted tightly over her black turtleneck and pants. Jared's green utility coat remained over the gray V-neck he'd layered over a blue button-down, black jeans, and white Common Project sneakers. Ivanka approached the registration table first. "Here you go," the lady behind the table told her. "What you're going to do is fill out the ballot in one of the privacy booths behind you. When you're done with that, you bring it to the scanner under the basketball net." The woman asked Arabella if she wanted a sticker, and Ivanka smiled and brushed her daughter's hair back as she thanked the woman. She picked up the ballot and showed it to her father. They locked eyes. This was really happening. Melania was next to approach the table, followed by Donald himself. Jared went up last. "Last name Kushner," he told the woman. Don Jr., his wife Vanessa, and four of their five kids showed up to the same polling station a little while later. Election Day happened to be Eric and Laura's second wedding anniversary, and the two voted a few blocks south at the 53rd Street Public Library. Eric proudly took a photo of his filled-in ballot and tweeted it out to his followers. It is, of course, illegal to take photos in the voting booth in New York, a fact that many of his nearly 2 million followers were quick to point out. He later deleted the tweet. They all wound up back at Trump Tower. Don Jr. did a bunch of local radio hits. They made calls to supporters and took calls from busybodies wondering what the mood was like inside. By around 5 o'clock, when the first dismal round of returns started rolling in, the three eldest kids started calling in to local stations in battleground states to make a last push. Jared made calls to a few media friends. He asked one high-up executive at a major media organization who'd known Kushner both professionally and personally for years what he was hearing about Florida, which at that point was their last hope for any path to victory that night. The executive told him it didn't look great, but what did he expect? "Did we get your support?" Jared asked. "No," the executive told him. "No, you didn't." Jared hung up and called Matt Drudge, another maher in the media circle he'd accumulated. The media had been off about the Trump campaign the whole time, Drudge told him. "Wait until the next couple of rounds of exit polls come in," he said. "That's when things could start to shift." Since before 5 o'clock that morning, campaign officials had been huddled on the fifth floor of Trump Tower, essentially an expansive, unfinished utility closet with concrete floors and no heat, which staffers in the early part of the campaign used as a makeshift headquarters. By the time sun set that evening, dozens of people packed the room as then-National Field Director Bill Stepien zeroed in on the campaign model, focused on Florida. Jared and Ivanka and Eric and Don began milling about, poring over maps and models and numbers coming in from their guys on the ground and officials in Florida feeding them what they knew. Donald was up in his triplex atop the tower, until after 8 o'clock when he called Ivanka, asking where she was. He told her to leave the 5th floor and come up to the 14th, the official headquarters, and he would meet her there. They looked like sardines, the lot of them. Donald, Melania, the kids, Pence, Kellyanne Conway, Steve Bannon, Reince Priebus, Chris Christie, Mark Short. The whole MAGA squad stuffed into that corporate-looking office, cramped around giant monitors and projections and TV screens as campaigners explained the numbers coming in and the New York Times prediction needle shifted slightly in Donald's direction. They stayed there until after 11, when networks and wire services called Florida for him and the tide started turning in other battleground states. They took the executive elevator straight up to the triplex, the family, the Pences, Conway Christie and his son Andrew, Bannon, Stephen Miller, Priebus, and David Bossie. The rest either stayed on the 14th floor or started to make their way a few blocks west to the victory party at the Midtown Hilton. Miller sheepishly approached a few of them and told them that he had prepared an exquisitely drafted concession speech. "What do we have on the victory speech?" someone asked Miller. "Bullet points," he said. So they pulled out a laptop and Miller, Pence, Ivanka, Jared, Don, Eric, and Christie started writing. Ivanka pointed out that it would be a great opportunity to reach out to women who undoubtedly would need it after watching the first female major party candidate lose. "Maybe we could mention parental leave or child care credit," she suggested. "Vonk," Jared interrupted, "this isn't the speech for that. We have plenty of time to get to that later." The rest of the people around the table exchanged glances and took a breath. If anyone could say that to her, it was Jared. They were just glad he had. Donald had been watching the returns on the small TV set up in the kitchen, repeatedly calling to check in on the victory speech he would have to give in a few hours. "We're just polishing it," they yelled to him, though technically there was not yet a fully formed speech to polish. "The truth is, we were cramming," one of the people around the table said. "But we couldn't let him know that." Once it became clear that things were going in his direction, the mood shifted to a mix of giddiness and shock. Jared threw his arm around Christie, saying, "We did this." Conway kept repeating, "Can you believe this?" Melania looked shocked, was mostly concerned with Barron, who seemed whip-tired on the couch. It was well after midnight at this point, and she focused on keeping him awake on the couch. Donald remained stoic, and Pence seemed a little more celebratory. Karen Pence, one observer noted, looked as though she were at a funeral. The ride over to the Hilton took less than 10 minutes. There, they waited in a tiny holding area off to the side of the main stage. That's when the Associated Press officially called the race for Donald Trump at about 2:30 a.m. Huma Abedin's name flashed on the screen of Kellyanne's iPhone, which she had on silent. A day earlier, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, Robbie Mook, had emailed Conway with Abedin's number. If Donald should win, he'd written, they would call him within 15 minutes after the AP's call. Abedin would be her point of contact. Pence had already gone on stage to address the crowd, telling them they were sure they had won, but were waiting for a Clinton concession and an official call. After Donald took the phone call and accepted Clinton's concession and congratulations, Pence walked over to his wife Karen and told her that they'd done it. They'd won. "I know," she told him coldly. "Well, how about a kiss?" "Mike," she said, turning to him, "you got what you wanted." Donald, now officially the president-elect, walked on stage just before the clock struck 3 a.m. to talk for about 15 minutes. "To Melania and Don and Ivanka and Eric and Tiffany and Barron, I love you and I thank you," he said about halfway through his speech after thanking his parents and siblings. "Especially for putting up with all those hours. This was tough. This was tough. This political stuff is nasty, and it is tough, so I want to thank my family very much. Really fantastic. Thank you all. Thank you all. Laura, unbelievable job. Unbelievable. Vanessa, thank you. Thank you very much. What a great group." Incidentally and accidentally, he forgot to thank Jared, the de facto shadow campaign manager, a body man meets yes man, bound to him in law and desire to make their families as rich and powerful, at least outwardly so, as possible. They got a few hours of sleep before Jared started making calls to close friends and campaign associates. Many of them had told him that November 9th would be a day of reckoning. They'd spent months warning him that people thought of him as a psychopath for supporting this campaign, or at best an asshole. They drilled into his head that no one was going to want to talk to him after the election, and that he'd face a steep uphill climb to rebuild his reputation and that of his family. What they call his big real estate reboot would begin on the morning after Election Day. "Prepare yourself," they would say. "You're going to get back to Earth, and it's not going to be the same place you left it." His response to all of this was a quiet, repetitive, "I know." That morning played out differently. The real estate reboot was scrapped. They had all been so woefully wrong. He and Ivanka had prayed for the right outcome in the election, he told his friends, and that his father-in-law was going to be a great president. Days earlier, on the Saturday before the election, after sundown when they could once again drive, they'd hopped in a car toward Cambria Heights in Queens, a largely black middle-class neighborhood where, on Francis Lewis Boulevard, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the seventh Grand Rebbe of the Lubavitcher Hasidic Dynasty, was buried alongside his father-in-law in 1994. The site of his tomb is known as the Ohel, the Hebrew word for tent, referring to the structure built around the grave. It is open day and night. Observers and believers have been making pilgrimages up to the old Montefiore Cemetery in droves for the last near quarter century, because the Rebbe, it is believed, will deliver those who visit the Ohel to God. A place to ask for blessings and scrawl prayers on the provided notepaper and toss them into the grave. It was uncommonly warm that November Saturday, hanging in the mid-50s even after dark. Jared turned up without a jacket, in a black cashmere sweater, flat front khakis and a yarmulke, Ivanka in a slanted black beret, belted coat, and bare legs. In the Ohel, they dropped their prayers into the grave before making their way back home. Friends joked that they weren't sure exactly what Jared meant when he referred to the right outcome, and whether their prayers had in fact been answered or rebuffed. After Jared made a round of phone calls, he and Ivanka took their eldest children to school, as they often did at Ramaz, the modern Orthodox Jewish day school on the Upper East Side. They were a bit frazzled and tired but buzzing, and more apparent, they were a bit late. The school has a separate elevator to take parents up to preschool classrooms, and because they were running behind that morning, the elevator had already gone upstairs. So they waited. They were sitting ducks in a fishbowl. One by one, parents approached the couple, offering their congratulations. The win had stunned them, they told her. It was remarkable. "She must be so happy, so proud." "Wow," others offered. "She beamed," one parent remembered of Ivanka. Graciously, she accepted every last word. Until then, parents at the school and members of their uptown shul had been split on the couple and their involvement in the campaign. On the one hand, the campaign had ignited a new wave of anti-Semitism and hundreds of dog whistles to white nationalists, alarming the Jewish community. After the president tweeted an image of Hillary Clinton with the Star of David and a pile of cash, one of Jared's own employees, observer, culture writer Dana Schwartz, wrote an open letter addressed to Jared in his paper, asking him to address the anti-Semitic vitriol spreading in his father-in-law's name that applies equally to your wife and your daughter. "Mr. Kushner, I ask you," she wrote, "what are you going to do about this?" Jared wrote his own op-ed in response under the headline, "The Donald Trump I Know." He defended his father-in-law as tolerant and said that the from-the-heart reactions of this man are instinctively pro-Jewish and pro-Israel. He invoked the story of his grandparents who survived the Holocaust as proof that he knew the difference between actual dangerous intolerance versus these labels that get tossed around in an effort to score political points. Some of Jared's own cousins, reigniting a more than decade-old family feud that had been punctuated by Jared's father getting sent to federal prison, took issue with this defense. "I have a different takeaway from my grandparents' experience in the war," Mark Kushner wrote in a Facebook post shortly after, linking to the op-ed. It is our responsibility as the next generation to speak up against hate, anti-Semitism or otherwise. Another first cousin, Jacob Schulder, was harsher. In a comment on Mark's post, he wrote, "That my grandparents have been dragged into this is a shame. Thank you, Jared, for using something sacred and special to the descendants of Joe and Ray Kushner to validate the sloppy manner in which you've handled this campaign. Kudos to you for having gone this far. No one expected this. But for the sake of the family name, which may have no meaning to you but still has meaning to others, please don't invoke our grandparents in vain just so you can sleep better at night. It is self-serving and disgusting." Jared's parents, Charlie and Cyril, were supportive of the Trump campaign, hosting a couple of open houses at their Long Branch, New Jersey beach house on Donald's behalf throughout the campaign. It wasn't an option not to throw their support behind Donald. In effect, that would mean not throwing their support behind Jared. They were proud of what he was doing, and whatever he needed, they would do. That their son was effectively running a presidential campaign gave them enough nachas for them to put their own distaste at some of the campaign nonsense and rhetoric aside. The Access Hollywood tape, for instance, rippled their household. But what rankled them wasn't Donald's language, that he'd boasted about using his special privilege as a celebrity to grab women by the genitals, or kissing a married woman he wooed with furniture shopping. It was that their son had walked to Trump Tower the day after the story broke to help handle the fallout. It was a Saturday, and their son shouldn't have been working. That, they told him, wasn't quite keeping Shabbat. What divided the community most unfolded over the summer of 2016. As the campaign worked with the Republican National Committee to put the schedule for its convention in Cleveland together, the Trump Kushners threw out an idea. Why not ask Rabbi Haskell Lookstein, who'd shepherded Ivanka through her conversion process years earlier and led the congregation the Trump Kushners attended in New York, to deliver an invocation, an opening prayer to kick off the convention? Lookstein had commanded the pulpit at the congregation Kehilat Jeshurun, or KJ, for decades, taking over the gig from his father. Israel's Bar-Ilan University had granted him an honorary doctorate in recognition for the influential role he has played in deepening Jewish values and heritage among American Jewry. The rabbi agreed, a personal decision that he said he made to honor her request out of respect for her and their relationship. In the lead-up to the convention, he settled on an invocation that prayed for the welfare of the government, thanking God for translating into reality the biblical commandment to proclaim liberty throughout the land for all the inhabitants thereof, and for the constitutional government that fostered the American ideals of democracy, freedom, justice, and equality for all, regardless of race, religion, or national origin. He would ask God to help us form a government that would protect us with sound strategy and strength, which will unite us with words of wisdom and acts of compassion. By all measures, it was a prayer most Americans, particularly those concerned by some of the campaign rhetoric and policies taking shape and gang who couldn't shoot straightness of it all, would have been heartened to hear. On a subtler level, it seemed almost like a troll of the candidate's positions on immigration and concerns over his tolerance for people who looked and lived differently than he did. Of course, that is not why the Trump Kushners asked their rabbi to participate. Jared and Ivanka felt like this was simple, a way to honor their rabbi with whom they had a close relationship, a member of the congregation recalled. But the simple things often turned complicated in an instant for everyone attached to the campaign, Ivanka included. The Trump campaign hastily sent a list of speakers, including all four adult Trump children, Vice Presidential nominee Mike Pence, former NFL quarterback Tim Tebow, former underwear model Antonio Sabato Jr., and Lookstein. No one told the rabbi that his name would be included on a publicized list, which means he had no time to inform the campaign officials that he was not, in fact, giving a speech at the convention. He was simply offering a prayer. The distinction may have made a difference to his congregants, or maybe it wouldn't have, given the immediate backlash he faced once the announcement went public. Congregants started an online petition signed by nearly 850 people, condemning the rabbi for lending his blessing to Donald Trump. Lookstein reconsidered. In a letter emailed to his congregants and friends, he wrote that the whole matter turned from rabbinic to political, something which was never intended. Politics, he added, divide people, and he had spent his life uniting. In the interest of bringing our community together, I have asked to be relieved of my commitment to deliver the invocation. Some guilt did wash over Jared and Ivanka for the trouble they caused the rabbi and for the controversy kicked up in their community. At the same time, they felt like they were getting hung out to dry and didn't see this as their fault in the slightest. An amateur level of organization created a problem that did not need to exist, one person who was part of the planning said. But friends and members of their congregation whispered that they should have known better. Part of this was that when you become a bigger fucking deal, one congregant mused, everything you do becomes a bigger fucking deal. And for some reason, they didn't catch on to that. Some people in the Trump Kushner's community, KJ members, Ramah's parents, people who went to the Modern Orthodox Yeshiva school that Jared attended in Paramus, New Jersey, thought it was a big fucking deal to have one of their own become a big fucking deal. On Saturday mornings throughout the campaign, as the rabbis spoke or cantors chanted, congregants would whisper that it was somewhat of a comfort to have him in the candidate's ear. He was a guy they davened with, who grew up the way they did, with the same kinds of values and priorities they were all taught in school and at home and in temple on Shabbat. It is still someone who we grew up with who's close to someone who may be the president, one acquaintance from high school explained at the time. That is never bad. Many agreed, however, that if they had their druthers, and it was up to them to choose a guy in their community who would be the one so close to and advising a U.S. presidential candidate, Jared would not have ranked high on their list. The consensus was that, without a doubt, there were smarter, more accomplished guys in his high school class alone who would have been perfect geniuses in that role. With Jared, the feeling was more along the lines of, well, I guess I'll do. He would not be the one who you'd be like, oh, thank God he's there, but it's a comfort, one of his high school classmates said. He wouldn't be a first or a second or third round draft pick, but great, we have someone there. He's totally solid and fine, maybe more savvy than smart. In terms of his relationship with Jewish community leaders beyond his own New York, New Jersey bubble, many influential members corresponded with Kushner often, voicing their concerns and urging him to push certain policy positions. They were heartened by his father-in-law's rhetoric when it came to his support for Israel, and for all the attention Steve Bannon got for the alt-right, white nationalist, neo-Nazi agenda pushed on Breitbart News, the website he helmed, he was an unabashed hardliner on Israel. Jewish organizations could tell that Kushner was overwhelmed and overworked. His father-in-law had tasked the guy, at the time a 35-year-old real estate developer who'd never worked for a place he or his family didn't own, with solving Middle East peace, along with all of his other campaign duties. It is true that he had a close familial tie to Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stayed at the Kushner family home when he came to the States, sometimes sleeping in Jared's childhood bed during his stays. But years of political know-how and understanding of an issue so complex that it has eluded seasoned diplomats for decades isn't like conjunctivitis. It doesn't rub off on shared pillows, nor is it picked up in conversations with a father's friends over Shabbat dinner. So Jared frequently relied on feedback and input from these organizations, though it was clear he barely had time to do so. He'd reply to emails with letters instead of words, always very short, almost like he was running around on a BlackBerry with one hand tied, one Zionist organization leader recalled. It was never a substantive discussion. It was more just trying to keep his head above water and get done what he absolutely had to get done. He did engage with the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the all-powerful pro-Israel lobbying group, throughout the campaign, particularly after his father-in-law hit the skids with the committee. Donald had particularly strained things when he said he would refrain from taking sides in peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians so he could fairly, credibly serve as a neutral negotiator. That, of course, is a third rail for organizations like AIPAC, particularly for a presumptive Republican nominee to take. The group's nerves were already frayed after 8 years of the Obama administration, which many perceived as a dark period of the relationship between the American and Israeli government. They would need stronger assurances of support from the campaign, particularly given its questionable ties to anti-Semitism and white nationalists, if they were going to get anywhere together. Kushner saw AIPAC's annual conference, an event held at the end of March 2016, as a place for him to both make good and make his commitments to Israel clear. The initial plan was that Donald would do a question and answer session at the event, but it soon got scrapped in favor of a speech. Jared suggested that Donald use a teleprompter, which, given the typical freewheeling, meandering style he naturally gravitates toward, was simple self-preservation. The stakes here were too high to let an ill-informed, breezy throwaway line turn the whole community against the campaign for good. Jared also urged his father-in-law to use the speech to lay out specifics that the audience would eat up. The remarks could be a proof point that Donald would not only charm them and entertain them, but knew a little bit about what he was talking about here, and most importantly, in fact, unequivocally have their back. Jared solicited the advice of Ron Dermer, Israel's ambassador to the United States. Dermer had talked through what could happen with the United Nations after the election with the Clinton campaign, and he wanted to share the Israeli government's point of view with both sides in language he felt comfortable with. At first, he sent over talking points Donald could use for the Q&A, but Jared requested a phone call once he knew the campaign had to plan for a speech. On the call, Dermer made it clear that he was doing this as a service for all campaigns. He talked for a solid hour about the UN, about Iran, about hard lines and language that was very important to Israelis, and about many people who would be in the audience that day. It was a solid foundation from which Jared and campaign officials could draw in drafting a speech, based on what fit with their own agendas and strategies and broader foreign policy goals. The truth was that those broader agendas, strategies, and goals, particularly when it came to foreign policy, were primordial at best at that stage. And so having Dermer spell out a fully fleshed out policy was like getting your hands on the answer key the night before a final exam that was worth 50% of your grade at the end of the semester. As Dermer laid out, piece by piece, bit by bit, the position of the Israeli government and the ways in which they wanted to hear a U.S. commander-in-chief relate to them and address the rest of the Middle East, someone was clearly taking notes. The next day, Jared sent a draft of the speech to the billionaire casino owner, GOP kingmaker, and major Jewish philanthropist magnate, Sheldon Adelson, who promptly sent it over to Dermer. The text Dermer read was like a transcript of what he had told Jared in their phone call, right down to the jokes. It was basically wholesale theft. Jared continued to polish over the weekend. He loved it. When Jared called Dermer back to give him a preview, it seemed like the campaign had used what Dermer said in their phone call almost exactly, adding a few familiar Trumpian rhetorical flourishes, a bunch of believe me's and plugs for his art of the deal. It was Dermer's substance, almost verbatim, put through a Trump speak machine and fed into a teleprompter for him to read to the crowd. The speech went through three main takeaways, all of which were very much in line with the AIPAC bent. First, his first priority would be to dismantle the disastrous deal with Iran, which he called catastrophic for America, for Israel, and for the whole of the Middle East. He laid out an uncharacteristically specific plan for what he as president would do and the specific problems he said the deal failed to address. Second, he vowed to move the American embassy to Jerusalem. Third, he ripped into what he called the utter weakness and incompetence of the United Nations, which, he said, was not a friend to freedom, nor to the United States, and surely not to Israel. He vowed to end the discussion swirling about an attempt to bring a Security Council resolution on the terms of an eventual agreement between Israel and Palestine. The United States must oppose this resolution and use the power of our veto, which I will use as president 100%. Next, he told the audience that Palestinians need to stop treating those who murder Jews as heroes and lionizing hatred in textbooks and mosques. But despite his son-in-law's warnings, the candidate couldn't help himself. He could read an audience. That was his one natural skill, so he threw them some red meat. With President Obama in his final year, he began, before interrupting himself with a, "Yay!" Like any performer worth his salt, he paused to let the crowd applaud and roar. He chuckled to himself, his lips turning upward in a grin, before he turned his head to take in the crowd. This is what he fed off, what set off that little clinking in his brain like a junkie getting a first taste before opening up wide. He heard the clapping and he wanted more. So he careened off the teleprompter and spiraled straight into rally mode, straight down into the mordancy that played so well to his base. He kept pausing and shaking his head as the rush settled into thought bubbles. "He may be the worst thing to ever happen to Israel. Believe me," he said to more hoots and hollers. And you know it better than anybody. His audience didn't necessarily disagree with these sentiments, but members of APAC's executive team started to scramble. Candidates didn't use this event to slam and attack other politicians. APAC President Lillian Pincus opened the next morning's events, during which Netanyahu was scheduled to speak, with an apology for the rhetoric Donald had run off with the night before. Barely swallowing back tears, Pincus indicated that the candidate had violated the nonpartisan spirit that the event tried to retain. The hubbub around Donald's comments overshadowed the one line he had been sure would get him into APAC's good graces. "I love the people in this room. I love Israel," Donald had ended with the day earlier. "My daughter Ivanka is about to have a beautiful Jewish baby. In fact, it could be happening right now, which would be very nice as far as I'm concerned." A week before the election, in the midst of all of this, Ivanka turned in the manuscript for her second book, Women Who Work, Rewriting the Rules for Success, to her publisher. The book was a marketing dream, the confluence of the company she'd built under her own name and the near constant attention on her speaking about paid family leave and childcare under the glare of the political campaign made a book like this the gold standard for the term brand tie-in. Ivanka had spent nearly a decade selling jewelry to women, and then clothes and shoes and handbags and accessories, and later, the notion of a put-together working woman who, if she doesn't have it all, wants to read about the interview-ready outfits and time-saving tips and recipes and workouts and ways to ask for a more flexible work schedule she'll need to get close to having at least some of it. Her brand website turned into a mecca for that kind of aspirational content, with blog posts about packed lunches and spring looks for the office, most of which let readers shop corresponding looks from the Ivanka Trump brand directly from each post. She had announced the book publicly in June in a video message posted on her website. "So last year I shared some pretty exciting news that I was pregnant with baby number 3, little baby Theodore, and today I have some amazing news to share with you as well." She held up a cutout of a white number 4 affixed to a stick, biting her perfectly berry-stained lips as if the secret would spill out if she didn't physically contain it with her teeth. True Ivanka Trump fans, the kinds of women who religiously read her website or leave comments on her Instagram photos praising her children or cataloging her outfits, would recognize this trick. When she announced her pregnancy with Theodore again in a video posted on her site, her first child, Arabella, had held a number 1, her second, Joseph, a number 2, and Ivanka herself held a gold number 3 up to her belly. "Okay, so I'm not pregnant with baby number 4, she said, doubling over her own black and white printed shift dress as she chuckled at her own joke. "But I do have another exciting project in the works, and it is also a labor of love. It's a book." The idea had been born 2 years earlier when she launched her first hashtag Women Who Work initiative. "I was advised by many of the top creative agencies to lose the word work," she wrote in her announcement. One after another, they suggested the idea women and work wasn't aspirational and wouldn't resonate with a millennial audience. "I disagreed. If you ask me, there's nothing more incredible than a woman who's in charge of her own destiny and working daily to make her dreams a reality." Over the last 2 years, my team and I have been laser-focused on making IvankaTrump.com the destination for professional women. Our site is home to inspiring thought leaders, smart content, and solution-oriented tips curated for women who work. Today, I'm beyond excited to announce the next evolution of our message, a book. When she took the idea to Portfolio, her publisher, half a year earlier, it wasn't a hard sell. At the time, they had no inkling that she would be turning in pages after more than a year stumping for one of the most polarizing